Anyway, perfect, yes. Over the next few days, I'll be doing some lecturing, we'll be doing some talking, we'll be doing some talk with your neighbors, some small groupings, and so I don't know how often I will be able to call out your names, but I'd like to if I'm able. So that's why I have the name tag, mail label things, if you're able to get one of those, you can get one next time. So welcome to this session. My name is Lori Pearson, and I'm delighted to be here. First time at Holden, so happy for this opportunity for conversation and for sharing some of the puzzles and problems that I like to kind of play with in my mind and that occupy me existentially as well. So I thought I would begin just with a little passage from Romans, because although we're going to be looking at a wide range of theological conceptions of God from mostly recent theologians, meaning the last 50 years, there's a common thread is the notion of the incomprehensibility and mystery of God and the complexity of God talk and the implications of God talk. And so it reminded me of the end of Romans 11, which people often clump together in Paul's letter to the Romans chapters 9 through 11, kind of an apex of his grappling with how to think about the relationship between Jews and Gentiles. And this apostle to the Gentiles, Paul, encouraging Gentiles not to boast in relationship to Israel. And the way he ends this little mini section is with a doxology or kind of statement of praise that really speaks to the mystery of God and doesn't really use any kind of incarnational language, which I think is really interesting. So this is verse 33 and following. Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God! How unsearchable are his judgments and how inscrutable his ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord? Or who has been his counselor? Or who has given a gift to him to receive a gift in return? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be the glory forever. Amen. So I want to talk a little bit about my topic and how I thought of these sessions that we're going to be stringing together this week. And I thought about this as I shared it the other night with some of the staff and heard wonderful stories about the image of water and rivers. And as I heard people's stories about experiences they've had with water and rivers, and I shared this with that group already, so apologies for the repetition, it became apparent that water is in some way, of course, a very kind of rich and positive theological symbol, but also a highly ambiguous symbol because it often involves terror and fear and near-death experiences, and it's overpowering and it's scary, as also it can be life-giving and etc. And so I thought, well, you know, the symbol of God is not unlike that God is also a highly ambiguous concept, a highly ambiguous figure in the various ways that the various personalities of God come to people through scriptural traditions and the ways in which God is talked about historically in the history of Christian thought, and certainly the ways in which God is experienced or in which God is doubted, but also just the experience of kind of being drawn to God, but also a kind of terror in relationship to the very idea of God. So I just thought this is an interesting kind of parallel to a lot of the ideas that I think about as a teacher of modern philosophy of religion. And my work focuses, and so therefore we will mostly focus on, the history of Christian thought in the modern period. A lot of the issues we're going to be tasting and sampling and playing with are not at all unique to the modern period. The mystery of God and the complexity of God and the difficulty of talking about God is an age-old issue. But I'm interested and kind of animated by the ways in which the encounter between Christianity and, or Christian theology and modern forms of knowledge and authority and modern problems and challenges kind of encounter each other and the set of philosophical and theological questions that arise from that encounter. So we're going to be thinking about the problem of God talk among some, just a handful of random but interesting modern Christian theologians. So I'll start with, I'm going to try not to be too jargonistic or too lecture-y in a philosophical way, but there are some, just a couple of frameworks I wanted to offer at the beginning before we get into our first case study, which is the work of a liberal theologian who comes from Mennonite tradition named Gordon Kaufman, but who died a couple years ago, died 2011, but who really articulated quite a radical conception of God in relationship to ecological and evolutionary concerns and worldviews. And so we'll be looking at his thought today to see how he plays with the concept of God. But before that, just a little bit of a framing. So, long quotation. But this is actually from one of the earlier works of Gordon Kaufman called The Theological Imagination, which I think is in the library. But one of his books I noticed was in the bookstore, a very recent one called In the Beginning, Creativity. But so one of the things that becomes a problem for God talk in the modern period, which we think of as maybe the 18th century to the present, is that it becomes difficult to think about whether one could really have authoritative knowledge of God in the ways in which we have authoritative knowledge of other things in our world through other academic disciplines. Okay, so this quotation expresses this conundrum in a sense, which says, God is not a reality immediately available in our experience for observation, inspection, and description, and speech about God or to God, therefore, is never directly referential. Thus, we are unable to check our concepts and images of God for accuracy and adequacy through direct confrontation with the reality God, as we can with most ordinary objects of perception and experience. So akin to, I can check my conception of this thing I'm kicking, or some experiment I do in a lab, I can have other people come and look at it, and a public community of scientists can agree on what we're observing and concluding, and there's still going to be a lot of complexity and disagreement, but obviously not an ordinary object of experience that we just encounter in the world of our empirical experience, right? Instead, our awareness and understanding here is gained, this is somewhat controversial, but interesting for this theologian, entirely in and through the images and concepts themselves. So the stuff we have to work with when thinking of God is through the very images and concepts of God themselves, because in his assumption, we can't sort of go to the object and look at it, okay, and inspect it and see if our descriptions correspond to the thing we're talking about. Okay. Instead, it involves kind of the creative, synthesizing, imaginative powers of the mind. Now, those imaginative powers may be informed by tradition and by history and social context and culture and scripture, etc., but still, we're working with a creative act here of the imagination. We're not making it up from whole cloth, but we are imagining. So again, entirely in and through the images and concepts themselves, constructed and focused by the mind into a center for the self's devotion and service. We don't need to dwell on this. It's just a taste of one way in which the problem of talking about God authoritatively in ways that kind of a public human community could agree with, right? Becomes problematic in the modern period. And there are various ways in which this problem of how do we speak about God if theological ways of speaking don't conform completely to other ways of speaking in other academic disciplines, for example, in a modern university. The ways in which this problem becomes articulated can be divided into different sections, and I offer these again not because you need to remember really what's here, but to give you a little bit of a foretaste of the different kinds of issues and angles we'll be approaching some of the topics in the next few days. So again, as this recent quotation that I just had up there illustrated, there are questions of authoritative knowledge with respect to God. What constitutes authoritative knowledge of God? What is the authority of God talk grounded, or in what is it grounded? Especially if one recognizes the ways in which our sources for God talk are clearly informed by historical, social, cultural contexts and various kinds of experiences. And what status could that God language have? And so that we could call an epistemological question, a problem about the authority of knowledge. Okay. Or questions of appropriate human action. How do concepts of God imply certain things or do justice to questions about how we ought to act in the world or in community or in relationship to each other in our private or larger public communities? Are we satisfied with what our traditions have handed us down in terms of God talk and the ethical implications that flow from different kinds of God talk? So that could be obviously a moral question the ethical implications of God talk, which flow into the final one, which is a metaphysical dimension, sort of the thinking about larger questions, larger images, very abstract images of the being of God and God's nature. Is God an agent? Does God act? Does God's agency conform to human agency? How would we know? What would that look like? These kinds of questions. Or if we think, how big is God's reality? What's the extent? What's the size of God's reality? And if we, again, what are the kind of ethical implications of different metaphysical portraits of God? What do they imply about the authority of our theology or the implications for how we ought to act in the world? So questions about God's nature. So the different theologians that I'm using as case studies, just as opportunities to kind of taste a few theologians, or maybe only four or five, or from mid-20th century forward, deal with some of these philosophical issues, but in relationship to concrete issues. So our case studies are more concrete, that have to do with, well, how does one think about the concept God in relationship to ecological concerns and an evolutionary worldview? What value or what are the disadvantages and advantages of different conceptions or ways of talking about God gleaned from tradition with respect to notions of race and racism? That'll be another day. How do we think about God's power? Is God weak? Is God strong? What do we mean by those things? How can we think about that in relationship to questions of gender and mass suffering? And then finally, what attitudes toward religious pluralism flow from different visions of God and certain kinds of radically monotheistic perspectives? Okay. So these are some of the tastes of what we're going to be looking at each day in this class. So now on to today. So today we're going to grapple with this question that comes up provocatively in the work of this quite liberal, controversial theological figure named Gordon Cochran, who was born in 1925, died in 2011. And the question that emerges as he tries creatively to redefine God as a symbol in ways that cohere with an ecological and evolutionary perspective on our kind of environment and our cosmos and on our world. The questions, the image of God that emerges from that and the question that arises, for me that's interesting is, can one talk about God loving humans? And we'll get to this point as to how this question emerges. If one, for example, in his case, gives up really human-oriented images of God, if you give up anthropomorphic or speaking according to the form of a human ways of talking about God, what becomes of traits such as love? And if you also relate that God talk to a much larger cosmic perspective on both ecosystems, but also larger evolutionary and sort of cosmic trajectories, does it really make sense to think about God in those terms? Now, again, I said before that this is not at all a modern question. Okay? Whether one can ascribe human traits to God has bothered and preoccupied theologians for centuries, and certainly, for example, both Thomas Aquinas and the Jewish medieval theologian Maimonides really worried about what they called corporeal images of God, the corporeality of God, that this was something to be avoided. And so thinking of God in terms that were too human or too embodied somehow were problematic. This is another version from a different perspective. So just a one-minute bio of he was taught for probably four decades or more at Harvard Divinity School, and was a Mennonite minister. He was deeply influenced by the tradition of pacifism in his own tradition, and also therefore very much moved by efforts to avoid idolatry. And so there's strong threads. He's a very liberal theologian, and therefore is seen as often on the boundary of Christian tradition. But I think it's interesting to note these threads to his own tradition in which he was ordained. That his commitment, in 1980, in the 80s,
was the president of the American Academy of Religion, the large scholarly society for scholars of religion, and gave an address then on thinking about God talk in relationship to potential nuclear disaster. So really reimagining God in relationship to that problem. And then later came on to take on issues of religion and science and religion and ecology, and really, again, rethought and criticized traditional images of God. But his concerns, again, stem deeply from this profound commitment to avoiding idolatry, to sort of affirming the notion that sort of only God is God, and God is the only proper object of devotion, and that elevating human things to the level of God is sort of the profoundest sin in some sense. And then also his concern with the violent implications of certain conceptions of God really resonates with his pacifist or Mennonite tradition. So I'm drawing on some of his later work just because I find it really provocative and it raises kind of fun questions to kind of roll over in our minds. And so he wrote again on issues of nuclear war, of ecological sustainability, and just on the nature of the human imagination as a site for generating concepts of God. So, so as I mentioned before, one of the things that drew me to this topic is just thinking about the symbol of God or the concept of God as an abstract concept as a highly complicated or complex term. And it's involved, historically, both anthropomorphic elements in tradition and in scripture and in experience. And so elements that are deeply shaped by imaging God in human terms and traits, but also abstract elements. So thinking about God as omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, but also Alpha and Omega, various kinds of images that are very abstract. Coffin is interested in interrogating a lot of these ways of conceptualizing God from tradition and highlighting the extent to which these conceptions of God all are constructed by the imagination in certain historical cultural contexts and reflect the worldviews and from which they derive and emerge, but also really engaging what this word God means. And so he thinks about, for example, there's lots of tensions just in the images inherited about God. We've talked about briefly anthropomorphic and abstract elements. There's popular images of God. There's very philosophical language for God. There's the whole problem of whenever one speaks of God, one is always subjectively engaged in what one is doing, and so it's hard to get any kind of objective conception of God, which may not be a problem. And then there's also a tradition of negative theologies that are rich, he thinks, in terms of affirming that we can only speak of God by negating what God is. So saying that God is not this, God is not that, but saying what God is difficult, but that we get to a deeper conception of God's mystery by continually going that way of negation, negating images, to remind ourselves that everything we say about God, we ought then immediately negate, because we have to respect the mystery of God. For Kaufman, he defines the symbol God, drawing on others, he doesn't really make this up, but as he says here, the ultimate point of reference in terms of which all else is understood, and the ultimate focus of human life and human devotion. So whatever God is in God's self, Kaufman says, well, I don't know. I mean, I might know, obviously, in various ways from tradition and scripture. But again, if we think about that very first slide, the complexity of really saying what it would be to know God is very acute. And so he thinks of the symbol God or the category of God as an important category that is the focus and source of orientation and source of action for people, a sort of the high point or the orienting point of a symbol system that shapes the way people think about the rest of their world, the way people think about the rest of their commitments, the way people understand kind of self
and world and other in relationship to God. So, in some sense, God is this mysterious kind of placeholder that one reverently kind of acknowledges, and acknowledges that one does not know, but acknowledges that, that God is most holy or a majestic figure, but that then relativizes everything else beneath that concept of God and is a source of orientation for how one views the rest of the world. Okay, so for him, he has a method of thinking about God as a constructive task, using the imagination, and this is why people often think of him as very much, as a very kind of liberal theologian on the boundary of tradition, because he does draw very creatively on the imagination and doesn't give as much weight to some of the sources of authority of tradition. He finds sources of authority such as the history of theology and New and Old Testament to be important and revelatory in a certain way, but not the only source for thinking about God and not something that he gives more authority to than other sorts of possibilities. And so one of the things that he comes up with, though, is that whatever one does with God, that God should be a symbol that always relativizes and humanizes everything else in one's worldview or symbol system. Okay. So if God is the only proper object of devotion that is at kind of the top of one's values, then everything else ought to be appropriately below it, again, avoiding idolatry, and everything else ought to be relativized. But that symbol God also historically, he thinks, in scripture and tradition and in the history of certain important moments in the church, have had, got, the symbol God has also, when it's working correctly, had a humanizing function. So it directs us toward more actions and ways of being that are compassionate and that foster ethical ways of living in relationship to each other. Okay, a little bit more and then we're going to talk a bit. So one of the things that Kaufman thinks about in this book called In the Beginning Creativity, he also wrote a much longer book of systematic theology called In Face of Mystery, which is sort of really an effort to kind of do systematic theology, so to redefine classic theological terms in light of ecological and environmental and evolutionary perspectives, is he starts to think that, well, the traditional concept of God, what happens when these kind of anchoring concepts, self, world, God, community, that we've inherited from tradition don't really fit with the ecological or evolutionary worldview that he, or the ethical concerns that are confronting one today, or confronting him today. What happens? What does one do? What happens when these traditional ideas, he thinks, encourage kind of dangerous suggestions that don't promote responsibility in the face of some of these challenges, but actually promote a lack of responsibility or kind of negative behaviors? That he ends up coming up with the desire to really try to think of a theology that gets rid of human-centered or human-oriented images altogether, and even human-centered values, and to think not to negate the value of human life, but to not think of God in human-centered terms, but to think of human values as one thing that's relativized in relationship to God among many other things. Okay, and so how could one image God if one said, well, I'm no longer going to use anthropomorphic terms, so human-oriented terms, or anthropocentric values, because I, Gordon Kaufman, am worried about the ethical implications in terms of fostering responsibility for the environment, responsibility for the earth, responsibility for our own kind of human, he calls biohistorical kind of trajectory that we're a part of as humans. What if we're going to get rid of that? What would I come up with instead? Okay, so, and I've given you a little preview here that he starts to think about God as serendipitous creativity. So, yeah?
Can I just ask, did he ever take a step back and look at himself in whatever this was, the 80s or 90s, and realize or ask himself if he wasn't just projecting a new set of human-centric values, the new 1980s liberal
right
about the environment, you know,
right,
just a new set of human values is projecting.
Right.
That, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, this book actually was written in the 2000s, but still, your question stands. Sure, he did. Well, I guess there's several tensions in his work, which is why I think it's just fun to talk about and fun to grapple with. And one tension is that God seems to have many meanings in his work. There's sort of God in quotation marks, which is sort of the concept God, the abstraction God, the symbol that we fill in with our language in different contexts and times and places and experiences, right? But there's also God's self, which is just this sort of mysterious X, which he understands through his own Christian tradition. But so there's sort of God and God's self, and then the symbol God, right? And then there's also a way in which his theology does call for new ways of thinking about God, that he wants to avoid idolatry. But then, as you say, you could come up with the same charge of idolatry against him, right? Is he elevating his own values?
His new values.
And applying them to God, and therefore also, not avoiding the problem that he's trying to kind of get away with. And I think he would say, well, no, I'm not avoiding that, but I'm kind of doing the best I can, and I'm not actually claiming the emotive authority to my theology that other theologies might. I'm acknowledging that theology is human work, it's his humanly constructed symbols, and that, so I think that's how he would respond to it, if that makes sense. He would say, it's not my place to think of someone else's theology or to think of symbolize God in a different way, but to put this forward. However, he does have, there is a way in which, because he takes on ecological issues and evolution and environmental issues, there is a way in which I think in these kinds of theologies that there's a sense in which there's a perspective like, well, we're all in this together because it's kind of a planet-wide problem, and even more than that, a huge problem that kind of calls all of us humans together to kind of join forces and address questions of ecological sustainability and of the future of life on our planet and beyond, et cetera. So there is a way in which his theology does kind of call all people to sort of listen. And then, like you say, he's also, it's hard to know whether he's also then just elevating his own ideas to and projecting them onto God. But again, he would not really dispute that. He would say, well, look, all we have, all I have are human terms, and I'm human. I'm not sure I can get out of that one. But this is the best idea I can come up with right now, drawing on the deepest parts of tradition that speak to me, meaning Gordon Kaufman, I'm talking about myself. and so he does, for example, use, I'm just looking at his doctrine of God. He also has a doctrine of Christ, and he qualifies his conceptions of God by saying, well, anything we say about God also has to have a Christomorphic dimension to it that's informed by the biography of Jesus of Nazareth and the way that he lived and the way that he's functioned in tradition and etc. So, initial answer, I hope, to that question.
Question, Matt.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think another response that Kaufman might have is that the church has always done that through
history. Yes, exactly.
So there's never been a time in which it was free of applying the doctrines of the times and their own beliefs to understanding theologies.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, so, right, that this is not any different than what's happened before, and he's trying the best that he can in ways that kind of encourage ethical modes of behaving in the light of this crisis that he's trying to address. Yeah.
I'm sorry to be simplistic, but I'm having a hard time getting started on this because, on the one hand, intellectually, it makes sense. Gee, it seems inappropriate to anthropomorphize God and use this tremendous concept. On the other hand, you got this guy called Jesus, and he was, incarnate God made man, and that would seem like certainly anthropomorphizing. And when he spoke about God, at least if the Gospels are to be believed, he did it in anthropomorphic ways. So what does he do? I mean, does he just suspend belief in that for a while, or how does he get away from that?
Did you want to venture a response to that?
I would take us a step further. Mm-hmm. And that same Jesus in his high priestly prayer in John 17 wants all of us who believe to be included in the Godhead. If anybody's got problems with the doctrine of the Trinity, the doctrine of the ality, which is introduced in that chapter, every time I've read it, it's just blown me away. I really struggle to deal with it. But if you talk about humanizing God, mm-hmm. we're all supposed to be a part of the Godhead. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How he would, just a quick response. I mean, good questions that don't really have an answer, right? And then we'll get back to a conversation in the slide I'm going to ask you to kind of talk with Hrdinger and grapple with some things out loud to each other. I think it's true. He does not have as strong of a Christology as one might in other streams of the tradition, which isn't to say that Jesus isn't an important symbol or that Jesus Christ isn't an important dimension of his theology, but he doesn't give the metaphysical claims about Jesus as much authoritative status as others would. And so that's why I've said that oftentimes people think of him as a kind of a very liberal theologian on the boundary. I'm uncomfortable with that classification of him, but because of these kinds of objections, he's not going to, he kind of takes for granted and feels certain conceptions of knowledge and what one can claim about existence and reality and God's nature also, but also Jesus' nature. And I think he would not accept traditional doctrines of, for example, two natures, et cetera. I think he would say they're rich metaphors, and in some way he could probably come up with a way of fitting that into creativity, kind of embodied through biological historical processes. So he's not just giving it up, and he's not flippantly throwing it away. But he wouldn't be worried about that in quite the same way. Because he's given up with that much of an authoritative Christology metaphor. And he does consider himself to be a radical monotheist, which doesn't mean he doesn't think he's a Christian. He does. and I don't think radical monotheism isn't Christian. That's not what I meant to say. But he does. He's deeply moved by a kind of radically monotheistic perspective. And so he is, concerned. He is concerned with the doctrine of God as a primary sort of focus of his intellectual theological work. But he's also worried about lending too much authority to the doctrines of tradition. So, but of course, some doctrines he resonates with quite nicely, like the moments of the affirmation of radical mystery, a radical trust in God's mysterious ways and providence that are part of all different streams of tradition, from Aquinas to Calvin to Paul, whoever, right? So there are lots of resonances, but yeah, he doesn't give that much of authority to Jesus as incarnate God in that specific way of speaking. Yeah. So, so serendipitous creativity is—it sounds a little flaky, I think, but it's an interesting idea, and he puts it to interesting kind of intellectual work, I think, in his theology. So he comes up with what would it mean to think about God as serendipitous creativity? So let's just talk, because I've been talking too long here. Talk with your neighbor about what these words mean to you. And you could add mystery, too. What does creativity mean? What does serendipity mean? How do you think this metaphor is working in his theology as you've encountered it so far? And then how does that relate to mystery as a category that's so important to him in his doctrine of God? So talk with one or two people near you to just get your thoughts flowing and to keep yourself awake and your mind going. Theologically, as a symbol for God, what do you associate with the word creativity, either with respect to God or not? Just popcorn it out. Creativity.
Expansive.
Okay.
Bringing into being something that didn't exist before.
Okay. Bringing into being something that didn't exist before. Right, excellent. And he does see a lot of interesting, since he's interested in religion and science, kind of interesting metaphorical overlaps with sort of Big Bang ideas or whatever, just sort of that novel creativity that one didn't expect, that one can't really account for. Okay, other things that you associate with creativity that seem compelling, or maybe also maybe uncompelling.
I find that too human, really.
Okay.
Like, if this is what he's talking about. Like, I don't
That's
know.
That's good.
You
yeah.
know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
To human ethics.
So here's what happened. He wrote one book a little bit earlier in which he used the same metaphor, and he started to use the word sort of God as this creative force somehow, and he thought, no, I'm trying to avoid human-centered ways of thinking. That implies a notion of agency, and I want to get away from agency, because humans are agents, right? We have intentions that we carry out, and we think of things, we have an arc that we're sort of moving toward with intentionality or something like that, right? And so I don't know that I want to say, Gardner Kaufman says, that God is creative in the sense of a creative cosmic force, because that still implies that I know something about the mysterious directionality of that creativity. So now you guys say, look, this is why serendipity is important, but a certain way of reading serendipity, it almost starts to sound to me like randomness. Because if you want to get rid of any kind of agency, right, to this creativity, and if you want to be surprised by the novelty of the gift of now I'm speaking theologically, sort of the gift or a gratuitous creativity that's truly novel, that one could not have predicted, and one doesn't know where it's going, and it doesn't have an intention, it's just kind of sprouting everywhere, right? That's less human-centered, do you agree?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I know what you mean.
It sounds a little bit suspiciously like irreducible complexity in that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Like creation science.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it's not.
It's not, right? Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. What about, how would this relate to mystery? Why would you think that serendipitous creativity is kind of friendly with his notion of mystery, or that coheres well with the idea of mystery? Do you have any thoughts about that? Or yeah, Phil?
Name tag notes.
Yeah.
I guess it, like when you asked us to think about these two words together, I don't know, I've been like doing a lot of this thinking already, but I've seems like you're going along the lines of evolution, or like,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. And so
mm-hmm.
I think there's something with the mystery in that for me is in like, why are these two things that came from the same thing supposedly before, why are they different and how? And that leads to a lot of like science and a lot of like curiosity, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so not necessarily like evolution in itself, but just kind of that like random, like chance changes that make things
mm-hmm.
all connected to some similar,
mm-hmm.
but their own
mm-hmm.
like expression of that.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
Well, I just think that when you think of God as mystery, it's really saying that we have such hubris to think that we can define God,
mm-hmm.
and then you put it together with serendipitous creativity, and it's kind of saying, you have no idea what God's up to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I like that. Yeah.
Say the other part of what you were talking about.
Tell me what I
said. You said, what she said was that what we see so often, almost on a daily basis, is God being boxed into a certain definition by any number of people or groups on a regular basis, so that he fits what they want.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so affirming mystery and this kind of, who
right.
knows what God is
takes
up to,
that
idea,
away from that.
Right.
That's interesting, because that anticipates, I think, how he defines faith. Because because one often asks, well, what in the world would faith mean to this guy who just seems like he's this constructive theologian who uses the imagination to kind of concoct these ideas of God, and then you're supposed to kind of pull the wool over your eyes and believe in them somehow, right? But he actually has a pretty profound notion of faith, and I think it's kind of related to what you're talking about. I mean, I think he does. I appreciate those moments of his work as much as I don't appreciate other moments. But I think that what would it mean really to kind of give up on the kind of certainties of what God is like, and to open oneself up, really, I mean, speaking traditionally to God's providence, which is a term you really wouldn't use, but you could think of that, right? If there's this serendipitous creativity that's mysteriously bringing forth novelty, and also, you know, it's also not all positive either. We're going to get to that. And you still have faith in this mystery that is kind of the whence of everything, then that's a pretty radical faith. Because you can't have kind of a corner of the market on what God is, or a boxed-in conception of what God is. There's a hand in the back.
I was just going to say the word serendipitous has connotations of something that you didn't expect but is welcome. It's a welcome surprise.
That's true. It's a positive
as opposed to
often.
A negative.
Yeah. Yeah. So is that, are you having trouble with that then? Because he seems to not
want
that.
Well, I don't, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how he
okay.
would answer to that.
Yeah. Right. Because one could think of, I mean, obviously all sorts of things, you know, that are creative, depending on how we use the word, and natural, are horrible. Right? I mean, there are horrors in nature. There are horrific, I mean, at least from all sorts of perspectives, including human ones, right? I mean, I guess a disease is in some weird way creative, but, you know, I don't want to have one, right? I mean, so it starts to raise these questions. What values are we associating with these words, and is he being careful enough, or how ought we be careful when talking about God in these terms? But yet, he's trying to avoid a set of kind of weighty conundrums as well, that he's kind of doing a good job avoiding, but then he's kind of getting a whole host of new problems as well. So, let's keep going. So he thinks of God as serendipitous creativity, and he thinks about creativity, as many of you said, as directing us to the coming into being of the new. And he thinks of serendipity as the notion of, like, more happens than one would have expected. And I'm not sure that more means positive, but just the kind of, gosh, who knew, you know, the unpredictability of things. And then mystery refers to, for him, both to kind of God's nature, but also to the fundamental limits of human knowledge, which is something he's very concerned to embrace, again, because of all the kind of different philosophical and even Mennonite kind of convictions that he has that inform his theology. Yeah.
Does it also include his problem with human nature itself?
Say more.
Well, the negative side of human nature.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Good. Yeah. So not just the limits of human knowledge in terms of what we can know,
but who we
but,
are.
But what we end up bringing about and doing in terms of a notion of sin or something or of, yeah, right, or of the kind of, again, the kind of ambiguous sides of human nature that is
sometimes just the horrors.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true, for sure. So there's just a couple more places I want to get us so that we can think about how he starts, I had a kind of one-on-one question in the back here about what status do humans ultimately have in this theology. We know he doesn't want an anthropocentric theology, not centered on human values, because he's trying to have a more ecological perspective and even a more kind of cosmic perspective. But presumably, you know, he still wants us to care about humans and human life, and how does that all kind of fit together? So how does he then, and again, he's proposing this as a metaphor, serendipitous creativity. He's not saying that this is what God is, but he thinks, If I, Gordon Coffin, want to craft language that coheres with my scientific worldview and the ethical challenges and my understanding of what it is to be a human being, what it is to be a world, what the system of nature looks like, what the cosmos, you know, what theories of the cosmos, et cetera. If I want my system of God to kind of cohere with that in some way, I'm going to try out this metaphor and see where it gets me. And what the test will be, I think, is twofold. One would be, will this encourage responsible action among humans, and in his case, among people of faith or among Christians, to work hard to be ecologically responsible? And the second concern would be, does this, project humility in the face of God's mystery? I think those would be probably his two goals or criteria or sort of values. So he thinks about then creativity, and we don't have to get into this, but he has actually different kinds of creativity. There's kind of evolutionary creativity. There's human creativity, which includes culture and history. And there's also the kind of creativity that's kind of akin to the origin of the universe. So he has creativity one, creativity two, creativity three, and he kind of draws all these out to kind of draw a picture of what different kinds of, he calls them trajectories of creativity in our kind of large universe. And so we're on the biohistorical kind of human trajectory in our ecosystem. And so that's just one trajectory of creativity in the vast universe that is God's creation. So we're one stream, but we're not the only stream or we're the only thread. And so what happens to our trajectory is one important event, but it's not the only important one. If one has, he thinks, a kind of God's eye perspective or something like that. So so I think the second question, so he says then again, so what would it mean if we said that we were going to offer creativity or serendipitous creativity as appropriate focus for devotion and worship, and that provides an overall orientation. And for him, orientation refers to the ability to act for our lives. All other realities being creatures, being finite, transitory, and corruptible, become dangerous idols when worshipped and made subject to human orientation. So what happens then, he relates this then to his traditional kind of monotheism, radical monotheism, which is a term that he borrows from H. Richard Niebuhr and various other theologians who thought about this idea, which I'm going to talk about later in the week. But so this creativity then could be humanizing, because it has brought about, as it turns out, our human reality, and all the values and meanings that we've then kind of built on top of that through culture and history and symbol and religious life and artistic life and et cetera. And the kind of humanistic or humane ways of living that have emerged in that trajectory and the not so humane ones. But it certainly, creativity has brought about humanizing results, right? And creativity, this creativity can also relativize all other kinds of pursuits. So calling into question and ultimately limiting us or the creativity of our biohistorical human trajectory in relationship to the rest of all that is. Okay.
Well, I have a question. How can creativity in this respect limit the human race and its creative projects? I mean, isn't that sort of a conflict there? Creativity limiting creativity?
Good point. Responses? Anyone want to think out loud? And how does that work? Or can you imagine how he might think theologically about this?
Can you say it again? How it?
The first part makes sense, right? But the second part, calling into question and ultimately limiting us and our projects. In other words, how does God's creativity limit us as His created people? He's gifted with apparently the same similar sort of creativity. I mean, where are the limits of human creativity?
Could destroy us, right?
Could, yeah.
No, I mean, that's some other kind of creativity, like a star, could just wipe us all out. If you want to go to the ultimate extreme.
I mean, our own creativity could wipe us out.
Sure.
Right. Yeah.
We've come close so many times.
Yes. Yeah. And he does say, go ahead, Chris.
Well, it strikes me that it could be understood not as limiting our capacity for creativity, but limiting the relevance of our creativity and our projects in relationship to the totality of creativity and the totality of of projects going on in a really expansive universe. Mm-hmm. So we might think our projects are super important, but that frame limits the importance and reality of our project versus everything that is.
Yeah, I mean, isn't this just medicine as a really good example of that. It's how important it is for us to be able to cure so many diseases when, relatively speaking, where is that on the cosmic? And how does that cause damage and make in relation to other beings?
Right, yeah, right, yeah.
I mean, it just kind of strikes me as sort of an academic's way of revisiting that classic moment when you feel tiny looking at the universe. You're on your back on the lawn looking at the Milky Way. I mean, and frankly, that the second point here, I could easily believe that had come from one of the new atheists arguing why we don't need God for morality. Hmm. I mean, you know, you know, if you say the creativity that's a goal oriented creativity, but just, you know, creative wonder of the universe puts us in our place. I mean, I've heard that argument many times coming from that perspective, that science and all its awe-inspiring knowledge puts us in our place. And then comes our morality, and we don't need God. And it sounds like you could make that argument. Mm-hmm.
There are interesting tensions here, and I do sometimes teach his work in conversation with actually with Richard Dawkins, but who I think is much...
I would see Dawkins
but
I'm
much less interesting intellectual than him, than Popper. But anyway, but still, there are interesting resonances. But... there's a couple things. One is that I haven't talked at all about his Christology, which again doesn't have the metaphysical status of a kind of traditional kind of two natures Christology or something like that. But it is a really important moment in his work that all that one says about God in tradition should conform, as he said, to kind of a Christomorphic principle. So according to the form of Christ, or how Christ would work as compassionate, suffering one for the sake of others. So there are moral, I think when he's, right now he's in his kind of, I have my metaphysician's hat on, and I'm thinking symbolically, but later I'm going to have my kind of ethical Christology hat on, and my kind of, you know, how to think about relationships with others and compassion and suffering, and I'll say some other things then. But this is the moment in my systematic theology where I'm really reflecting on the doctrine of God. So that's one place where I think he would say that there are sets of values that come from tradition, from both the history of Christian thought, from scripture, from the very idea and actions of Jesus, and also the doctrine of Christ. So again, he also is very critical of certain moments of the doctrine of Christ. But I mean, what theologian isn't, really, right? But so that's one thing. And the other thing is that I think it is interesting to me that I do think that one thing has authority in his theology. And oddly, I think that is God. And so I mean, I see what you're saying. There's a lot of resonances with the new atheist here, or kind of us. But I think he really does have a kind of devout sense that, you know, that there is some mystery that is the source of all, and that there's a reverent kind of silence and devotion in the face of that mystery that makes his thought have a different flavor, at least, than the new atheist. So I don't think that anything has authority really in his theology except God. But the problem is, of course, since God is mystery and incomprehensible, and he doesn't think that we is a proper object of knowledge akin to other kinds of knowledge, it's hard to kind of get at what that God is, except that there's this reverent, humble acceptance of that, which again he expresses as a radically theocentric theology, a radically monotheistic kind of presumption or sort of anchor in his theology. Okay, yeah.
You started this out with that quotation from Romans, and as you read it, I heard God talking to Job, saying, "Who are you, and where were you?" And I'm wondering, did Paul have that text from Job? Is that really the anchor for that whole text?
Well, I think is I don't it know. A recasting? The biblical scholars in the room would know, but he definitely does. Like, does the pot get to protest against the potter? I mean, there's all. I don't know. Can you help me out with this one? Sure.
Well, the speaking is in a different direction. It's Paul talking about God rather than God talking to Job.
Yeah. Right.
So
that's a good point.
You change the direction,
but the language.
But he does often echo in that. You know, as you know, that there are all sorts of ways in which God does weird things that, from our perspective, that seem weird or unfair, and yet, you know, end up either having some kind of purpose or else that we don't have the right to protest, but there's this kind of reverent sort of acceptance of the kind of crazy things that God does, right? That's what I hear there, is that, well, you know, what are the Gentiles to say if God's going to save all of Israel? Like, just shut your mouth and be fine with it, because look at all these other things that God didn't justify himself, and God, you know, et cetera. So, yeah.
Yeah, and one fundamental piece of that seems to be that Paul is also not in the business of limiting God, particularly with regard to grace and the Jew.
Yeah.
So that Christians are going to have this radical sense of grace. Mm-hmm. Who are they to limit it?
Right.
To the Jews as well. And that's what the doxology mystery is at that point. It's about grace.
So that's, and kind of the, I don't know, the extravagance or the extent of it, or the unknowability of its ultimate trajectory or its doings, you know. And I think there is a hint of that here in some sense, that, well, look, there are these trajectories and these creative moments, and if, I mean, again, he's imagining God. He doesn't want to conflate serendipitous creativity is not properly, literally God, right? He's using this as, you know, a thought experiment and a rich way that might enhance Christian faith that's ethically minded in his liberal way about ecological issues, right? He's not sort of pretending to have a view from nowhere, et cetera. So yes, that's a good point. We're just about running out of time. I believe we really are out of time, but I'm going to try to smuggle one or two more minutes. But So basically, the provocative question that emerges, and I don't worry about the next slide, which is again a long quote, just the last sentence I'm going to tell you about. Oh, yes, this is right. Is that he does raise this question about God's trajectory in relationship to humans that calls up questions, I think, that I want us to think about over the course of the week as well, about sort of what is the status of humans in this kind of theology. Again, what would faith in this kind of God mean if anthropomorphic conceptions of God aren't viable? And we're not, all the theologians we're talking about are not going to say this. They're going to say different things. But does it make sense to say that God loves humans? And how committed are we, on the one hand, to this radically theocentric perspective, which God is at the center, in which human beings and their importance are relativized, right? And therefore we say something as austere as he says at the end of this quotation, in which he says, you know, we do not know what direction this evolutionary historical trajectory will move in the future. That's ours, right? Perhaps toward the opening of new possibilities. Perhaps going beyond us in historicity, however difficult it is to imagine that. Perhaps coming to an end in the total destruction of human existence. I mean, that's probably going to happen, right? And God's going to go on. Okay. So there's that. Right. So how do I imagine God in that way? And does that? What would God's love mean for humans in that way, in that vein? But then, on the other hand, how committed, how much does that, as compelling and threatening or austere or robust of that notion of faith could be, there's also this protest that we heard, I think, from over here at the beginning as well. What about the importance of the human-centered or humanly affirming dimensions of theology? Human beings are created in the image of God, the notion of God is incarnate, etc. Do we really want to give up these ideas, or what happens to these ideas in these kinds of theologies if one really has a theocentric perspective? Does one have to ultimately accept that we're giving up somehow the ultimate kind of end and survival of humans somehow? What would that mean theologically in a larger theological kind of imaginative universe somehow? So this is the kind of, there's lots of good questions you've raised. There's lots more conversations to be had. There's one or two other moments in the other sessions I've planned where we're going to get at some of these issues. Some will be in radically the other direction, but pushing against some of these conundrums and their implications for us, whether they be ethically, theologically, relationship tradition, experientially, psychologically, etc. That's where I kind of want to have us journey together as we think about some of these kind of more radical modern theologians that I'm going to be talking about this week. So thank you for coming.
Thank you.